Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This afternoon, the first doses of the COVID-19 vaccine in Vermont are being administered to healthcare workers at UVM Medical Center. Vermont has already received initial shipments of a few thousand doses, and more are expected this week and in weeks to come. Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine said today that Vermont could expect to have 34,000 doses of the vaccine in the next couple of weeks, assuming the FDA gives emergency use authorization for the Moderna vaccine, as it has for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. But this positive news comes as the U.S. crests 300,000 deaths and as the speed of fatalities increases, not just in the U.S., but in Vermont as well, where 15 people have died in the past week, bringing our state's total death toll to 100. So health officials caution that we're still in for a deadly winter, and it will take several months just to get through the high-priority populations for vaccinations, and longer still before we could expect to see life return to anything close to a pre-pandemic normal. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk a lot about the vaccine and how it's being distributed in the state of Vermont. And we're going to take your other COVID-related health questions in our weekly health update. We are joined for the full hour today by two deputy health commissioners. Tracy Dolan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And Kelly Dougherty, welcome to you as well. Deputy Commissioner Dougherty leads the state health department's vaccine planning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
So there were a lot of numbers that came out of today's press conference from Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine about how many doses were arriving in Vermont this week and next week and in the following weeks and how many have been pre-ordered of the Moderna vaccine. And I couldn't keep them all quite in my head. Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, can you run us through the numbers as you know them right now? And if not all of the numbers, just enough to get us a sense of how many doses we're likely to receive and when and what the state is thinking.
Sure. So, as you know, we have the Pfizer vaccine, which is now being used, and we are receiving 5,850 doses of that per week through the end of the month. We did pre-order the Moderna vaccine in hopes that it receives its EUA approval or emergency use authorization later this week. So we have placed a pre-order for 11,400 doses to receive next week and 5,000 doses at the end of the month. So like Dr. Levine said, we're expecting in total over the first 3 weeks of this effort to have about 34,000 doses of vaccine in the state, that being a combination of the Pfizer and Moderna.
And the Moderna, we do expect to see emergency use authorization as early as the end of this week, right?
Correct. The FDA is meeting on Thursday, and then the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices will be meeting on Saturday and Sunday, similarly to what they did last week, to review the FDA's recommendations and to make their own recommendations. So we're hopeful that we could hear as soon as Sunday around the advisory committee's recommendations and hopefully on Friday for FDA.
Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, those 34,000 doses that we could expect to see by the end of the month, will that won't fully cover priority group 1A once we get to all of the people who are encompassed in that group, is what Dr. Levine said today. Can you talk about who's in that group?
Yes, that is correct. Sure. So the priority population for this first phase or phase 1A of the vaccine rollout are first long-term care facility residents and staff. As you and your listeners know, our long-term care facilities in Vermont have been hit very hard by COVID. So they are certainly a top priority to get those folks vaccinated. Then we have healthcare workers who have direct contact with patients. And I want to be clear that when we're talking about healthcare workers, we're not just talking about physicians and nurses, but we're also talking about support staff. So it could be housekeeping staff or nutrition staff who have direct patient contact. We sort of have a cascading prioritization within 1A. So we have people who are in settings at high risk for COVID-19 patient contact. So for example, people working in inpatient settings in the hospital, in the emergency department, or in intensive care units. Then we have people who are caring for COVID patients, maybe in other settings. We know that there are many home health providers who are caring for patients in their homes who have COVID. And then EMS workers who have patient contact. And then we sort of come down to the rest of the healthcare worker population who, you know, still has potential to come into contact with COVID patients or to transmit COVID to their patients, but maybe aren't as quite on the front lines as those other groups.
So those 34,000 doses that will still, that we will still be in priority group 1A, you know, by the end of the month when we're getting perhaps up to 34,000 of those initial doses.
Yes. Yes, we will.
You know, we're getting a lot of questions, as you both might imagine, about people who are concerned about how do I know when I'm going to be eligible? How will my physician or some other healthcare provider notify me or know? Or, you know, what if I have other conditions and I'm not sure if they know about my conditions and where I'm going to fall on the list? Tracy Dolan, it occurred to me today during the press conference that healthcare facilities and primary care practices may need to be fairly proactive about this, even if they don't know when their patients are going to be getting the vaccine. Is the health department reaching out to say, just send a note to your patients, letting them know they are on your radar? You know, is there any way to do that so that primary care practices are not bombarded by people who say, I just want you to know that I want to get it when I can. When can I get it?
Yeah, I think actually Dr. Levine addressed this also during the press conference. He noted that it's probably not a good idea for patients to call their physicians right now or their primary care providers to say, hey, what about me? I just want to be on the list. We know that primary care docs have a good sense of their patients and what conditions they have. And certainly part of our outreach will be working with primary care docs to make sure they understand the outreach, when it needs to happen, and coordinate that with the rollout of the vaccine.
But specifically, shouldn't that be happening now? I mean, that's what I mean. Dr. Levine said, don't call your primary care physician. But if you don't have any sense that your primary care physician even knows if you're that you're there, or maybe you haven't been to the doctor in years and you have insurance, but you're not sure that you're still on the rolls, if you're not getting any notification that says, don't worry, we gotcha, I mean, it seems natural that these offices are going to be getting calls from people. So rather than saying to people, just wait, is there an outreach to physicians' offices and health offices saying maybe you should just send a note to any patient that you have?
I think that's all part of the planning after we get through this group, but I'll defer over to Kelly. Maybe she has more specifics on how primary care is going to be reaching out.
Yeah, so we, like Tracy said, we're pretty laser focused on phase 1A right now, and that the healthcare providers, but we recognize that, you know, you can't look at any news right now without hearing about the COVID vaccine. So I'm sure that there's a lot of interest out there among the general population who aren't a healthcare worker. So we are developing communications around COVID vaccines so that we can not only outreach to the general public, but also to the provider community about our plans so that they're aware that, you know, it may not be available to your patients until the next phase. And here are some talking points that might help with that. But we are planning a lot of public communication once we get out of this initial phase to let sort of the general public know when it's their sort of turn. And most primary care providers and other providers just through their electronic medical records have a good sense of who in their patient panels are at highest risk. So we expect that they will have mechanisms by which they can sort of identify an outreach to those patients who may be at the top of the priority list, depending on what our phase 1B looks like.
Let's go to the calls. James is on the line with us from Westport, New York. Hi, James. Go right ahead.
Hello. Thank you. Are healthcare workers required to be vaccinated? And if not, why not?
That's a great question, James. So right now, there is no requirement for healthcare workers to be vaccinated, at least no requirement from the state. I imagine that employers can make their own decisions about whether they want to require the vaccine for their healthcare workers, but that's not something that would come from the Department of Health.
That was a little confusing to me in today's press conference. It sounded like Commissioner Levine was saying that because the vaccine only has emergency use authorization, it can't be required by employers for as a condition of employment. Do either of you have any more information about that? Because that was the first that I'd heard of it, and I haven't had time to research it yet. But he did say because it has an emergency use authorization that it can't be mandated.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Although I, somewhere down the line, we expect that the vaccine manufacturers will apply for full approval, at which point that, you know, that could be a policy decision that an employer makes. But that's my understanding, that as long as it's being used under an EUA, it cannot be mandated.
Let's go to Roxanne. Roxanne's on the line with us from South Burlington. Hi, Roxanne. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking the calls, and thank you so much for doing this program. It's so helpful. My question is, my husband's at a long-term care facility. He tested positive a week ago for COVID. Doesn't really, he's just tired. Other than that, he doesn't have a lot of symptoms. And so I'm wondering, when it comes time for them to get the vaccine, can he still get the vaccine?
Roxanne, I'm glad to hear that your husband is responding well so far. Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, when might someone who tests positive, who's in that priority group 1A or any group, be able to get the vaccine?
Yep. So they, there's no reason why your husband, Roxanne, couldn't get the vaccine. They do say that 90 days after an infection, the evidence is that reinfection is uncommon in that period, but also given that your husband is in a long-term care facility, that inherently places him at higher risk. So anyone can get vaccinated, even, you know, post-infection, if they so desire. The only caveat that I will add to that is, if someone is infected with COVID and they get the monoclonal antibody treatment, then it's recommended that their vaccination be deferred for 90 days after that treatment to avoid any interference of the treatment with their vaccine immune response.
And so far, it sounds like somebody who's responding well, who does not need hospitalization, would be less likely to get that monoclonal antibody treatment, right?
Right. Actually, the monoclonal antibody treatment is used in an outpatient setting, although you have to physically go into a facility to receive it. But if someone receives no treatment for their COVID infection, then they do not need to wait to get their vaccine if it's made available to them.
Reg is calling from Bennington. Reg, go right ahead.
My question is, I get my primary health care through the Veterans Administration and the VA, and I'm wondering, when it comes my turn, will my chance to get the vaccine be based on the state's regulations, or does the VA, will they have a separate, because they're a federal organization, will it be based on some different schedule?
That is a wonderful question, Reg. And I, the VA is sort of separate. They're receiving their own separate allocation of vaccine. So the numbers that we spoke about at the top of the hour, the VA's number of doses is not included in that. I honestly don't know what their prioritization scheme is at the VA, but I imagine it would be, depending on how much vaccine they're getting, that they would have a similar sort of vaccinating higher risk people first and then going down from there. But I would check in with the VA and see what their plan is. It's a great question.
Laura in Verscher says, I'm an EMT in Vermont, and I'm scheduled to receive a dose of the Pfizer vaccine soon, perhaps this week. My question, we know the vaccine protects the person receiving it from contracting COVID, but does the vaccine also help keep the vaccinated person from spreading the virus? In other words, if I am vaccinated and exposed, but do not get sick, can I still spread the virus? Deputy Commissioner Dolan, it sounds like more research is needed on that. Tracy Dolan, do we have you? Deputy Commissioner Dougherty?
Yes.
Oh, there's
yes,
Tracy.
I'm here. Go right ahead. Sorry about that. Yeah, I was hitting the wrong button. Sorry. Yeah, so we're waiting more research on that. Right now, we are asking people, and that's a big part of why we're saying a lot of things won't change in the initial stages here. People will still need to mask and distance because we're less certain about the transmissibility of the virus, even if you are vaccinated. We are hopeful based on the first two trials, but we don't know yet. And so with that learning, we will learn more over time.
And so someone like Laura, who is a first responder, Laura would get the vaccination to protect herself, but should still assume that she'll be wearing a mask for a significant amount of time to protect others in case she could have that active virus in her nasal passages, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
Chris in Springfield says, how much infection protection does the first dose of the vaccine provide versus the second? And will there be some sort of documentation provided so that sufficiently vaccinated people can be accepted into groups that have been closed because of COVID? For example, schools and colleges that have been closed to volunteers. Let's take that first half of the question first. How much infection protection is transferred in the first dose of the vaccine and the second dose of the vaccine? And we're talking here about the Pfizer vaccine because that is what is being administered first. But the Moderna vaccine sounds fairly similar. Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, is that something you want to tackle?
Sure. What I've seen is that the first dose can be up to 80% effective, but then it goes up to 95% with the second dose, which is a pretty great response. But we encourage people to receive the full course of the vaccine so that, you know, the protection can be optimized.
How long does it take for somebody to get the full level of immunity?
So for the Pfizer vaccine, the two doses are given 3 weeks apart. And then it is, we say like 10 to up to 2 weeks after the second dose when you would reach the full level of immunity.
So it sounds like, you know, 3 weeks plus two. So it could be five or 6 weeks before someone should assume they've had the full level of immunity conferred to them.
Correct.
And then Chris's second question is about documentation. So vaccinated people could do various things. Deputy Commissioner Dolan, that's an interesting question and one that I don't know if the state is grappling with, but certainly federally, various countries are grappling with this. Various companies are looking at this kind of thing, too. Will there be some sort of COVID vaccination passport that would allow someone to travel to a different country that has, you know, strict rules on people coming into the country, for example? Or Chris is wondering, you know, about volunteers at a local college.
Sure. I think those are great questions. I don't think we know what that's going to look like yet. Some people talk about having a card or some evidence that you've been vaccinated. We don't normally do that in terms of just people's day-to-day lives, although certainly vaccination cards have been used in the past to be able to meet requirements to travel. For example, yellow fever for many years was a required vaccination for travel into certain countries. So it's possible, but right now there are no plans in the works in Vermont. And I'm going to defer to Kelly and see if she knows more about that.
Yeah, that conversation has come up, but because, you know, people can still potentially transmit COVID-19 even when they're vaccinated, you know, I think at this point, we're reluctant to say when you're vaccinated, you sort of have a free pass. So again, you know, that's why we're imagining that we're really not going to see a whole lot of change in the masking and social distancing and all of that, at least until the fall of next year.
When do you think, Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, will know about whether someone who's been vaccinated can still transmit active virus to someone else?
That's a great question. I think that the studies are ongoing. I would hope that we would know something, you know, within the next several months. But off the top of my head, I do not have a timeline for that.
We've been talking about who gets the vaccine and how to get both doses to get the highest level of immunity possible. Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, how will people who get the vaccine be tracked by the state?
So the Vermont Department of Health has for many years run an immunization registry. So we receive reports of vaccine any vaccine that's administered by a provider in the state or a pharmacy is transmitted to our immunization registry, so that anywhere you go, people can see, you know, in your healthcare records, your vaccine, and you can also get documentation of your vaccine status. So we'll be using the immunization registry to track our vaccination efforts. And then there is a lot of reporting that will be done, de-identified reporting, so not with any personal information in it, that will be sent to the CDC so that they can track sort of how much of our vaccine we're using and sort of what populations we're vaccinating.
How actively are health officials and primary care officials expected to sort of chase down people who've gotten one dose but not two?
Ooh, that's a great question. So we are working on second dose reminders, ways to electronically sort of give people reminders of their second dose. We're also going to be encouraging people when they schedule their initial appointment for their vaccine, for their first dose, that at the same time they schedule their second dose appointment so that we can catch them, you know, right then and there, just sort of like when you go to the dentist and you schedule your 6 months out while you're there. And we're also even talking about, you know, low-tech sort of solutions of actually giving people a card with their second appointment reminder on it, and even encouraging them if they have the capability to like take a picture of it with their smartphone. So we're really looking at redundant operations so that we can make sure we capture those folks. But there will be a mechanism for, you know, providers already have these mechanisms in place where they can reach out to people and remind them of their appointments and remind them of their second doses. So we'll be implementing redundant systems so that we can make sure as many people as possible get their full dose of COVID vaccine.
If something unforeseen happens and you can't get your second dose at the 3 week mark, is there a problem with getting it after later than that, you know, 5 or 6 weeks? Is there something special about the 3 week mark that has to be adhered to?
There is a grace period, I apologize off the top of my head, I don't know what it is. So it doesn't have to be exactly at the 21 days. They still encourage people, if you can't get it in 3 weeks, to still get it. I don't know what that outer window is, but I believe that it's, you know, at least a few weeks, but I'll have to check on that.
Let's go to Steve calling in from Montpelier. Hey, Steve.
I've got a couple questions. One relates to the folks who are in the congregate shelter. I know that Christ Church in Montpelier has opened a shelter where the cots are like head to toe. But there's a lot of the folks, the homeless folks, that don't have phones or text-capable phones, et cetera, and even keeping track of an appointment can be a challenge. So that's one question. The second is, we've spent millions on putting out wireless broadband or erecting the towers so that we could get folks for telemedicine, remote work, and distance learning online. But that requires entering a person's house. And should there be a system to expedite vaccinations for folks who necessarily have to go into people's homes, putting both parties at risk?
Yeah, Steve, thanks for those questions. So let's tackle that first one that you asked first about, and you were looking specifically at homeless populations who are and people who are unsheltered but who may be living in congregate settings like a church or like a shelter, who may be at high risk of the virus but also may be at high risk of not being contacted or having a harder time making both appointments. Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, what kind of plan is being made for people in that kind of situation?
Yeah, we certainly have thought about those populations in particular as we've looked at the different populations through the phases of vaccine. So, you know, we have a particular focus on people in congregate settings. Granted, that's not in the 1A group, but, you know, we'll be somewhere, you know, following the 1A group. And we have been working throughout the COVID response with organizations that serve people who are experiencing homelessness or other at-risk populations. And in fact, we do have on our Vaccine Implementation Advisory Committee, we have someone who is a co-chair of the Vermont Coalition to End Homelessness, because we wanted to make sure that we were taking that population into account as we planned our vaccine efforts. So I think that what, and again, because we've been so focused on 1A at this point, we haven't dived into the details yet on this, but we imagine, just like we have with testing and other outreach to those populations, that we would engage with organizations across the state who serve them. So the operators of shelters or other social service agencies to help us reach those folks. And it may even be a situation where, you know, our district office staff plan to do vaccination clinics, and often we do them for people who maybe are uninsured or underinsured or who have other factors that make them difficult to reach. So we could engage our teams to go in and vaccinate those folks and have a system by which we would come back in to deliver that second dose. So we are actively thinking about those populations to ensure that that they don't fall through the cracks as we're rolling out vaccine more broadly.
Well, and Steve's second question, I'm going to pair it with a couple of other questions that we're getting, because Kelly Dougherty, you've mentioned that beyond 1A, the state hasn't actually explicitly determined the order of who gets the vaccine when. I mean, you have sort of broadly speaking looked at populations and risk and, you know, sort of laid out a plan. But in terms of like very specifically which kinds of workers and when. So, you know, Steve said, what about people who are putting broadband into other people's homes so that they can work from home or their children can do remote schooling? Could those kinds of workers be prioritized? We got a note from Lee who says, I'm a commercial cleaning contractor and the bulk of my work is to clean for an affordable subsidized housing. Early on in the pandemic, I was told that the state considers me an essential worker, and so I've continued to work. Where do I stand with regard to getting the vaccine? Should I call my healthcare provider? I'm nearing 65 years old, but not there yet. And Guy and Benson, I know you're on the line with us, but I'm just going to paraphrase your question so that we can sort of condense them all. Guy says, what about town officials? When are town officials in line for the vaccine? And Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, I know you must be getting a lot of questions and some sort of advocacy from various groups who say, you know, this is a group of people or a group of workers who are, you know, vulnerable for these specific reasons. Where are they going to be in line? So how are you determining that?
Yes, this is a very hot topic right now. And I'd like to just start by saying I'm so happy to hear that there's so much interest in the vaccine among all of these folks. We are certainly getting a lot of outreach and advocacy from them, which I take as a good sign. So we are starting to look at sort of what we're thinking of as frontline workers. There's a distinction between those folks who are quote unquote essential versus those people who are really coming into contact with a lot of people. So I might be essential in that I am a snowplow driver and I'm in my truck by myself, or I'm working on a utility line alone. I'm essential, but I'm not necessarily coming into that much contact with other people. So we're really trying to dig in to the workforce data, and actually had a great conversation with our partners at the Agency of Commerce and Community Development and the Department of Labor, who are helping us sort of dig into the data, because we are going to have to parse those sort of essential slash frontline workers and figure out who is at most risk, so that we can you know, while we expect vaccine to still be in limited supply, which will hopefully be short term, and we'll be able to open it up to everyone. But we're, in addition to looking at the data and how many people are in these different sectors, we're also looking at data from the pandemic so far, and where have we seen workplace transmission, where have we seen outbreaks in workplaces, and what types of workplaces were they? What sectors do they represent? So that we can really make a data-informed, take a data-informed approach to sort of breaking apart those sectors and starting to prioritize them. So actually, that's going to be part of the work that we're, you know, tackling this week with our implementation advisory committee.
Before we get back to listener questions, let's turn for a few minutes to Jessica Abelez, who's the pharmacy manager at Northwestern Medical Center in St. Albans. Jessica, nice to have you on the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So I understand that Northwestern Medical Center is getting the first doses that your hospital will receive today. Are they there yet as we're live here at 142?
They are not here yet, but yeah, we are expecting hopefully our first shipment today.
About 145 doses, is that right?
We will, yep. We'll get about 145 for week one.
And they are going to live in your office? You have the cold storage in Northwestern Medical Center?
We do, yes. Pretty small area, and we knew we wanted them secure, and we knew we wanted them in the pharmacy, and didn't have a ton of space. So I did graciously give up my office to put an ultra freezer in there.
Are you among few hospitals in Vermont, or do you know of others that have that ultra cold storage already, you know, already at your facility?
You know, I don't have the numbers, but my understanding is that there aren't a ton of facilities that have the capability, and those that may have had the capability don't have enough to store the minimum quantities required for shipments.
Why does Northwestern have one of these ultra cold storage gizmos?
We got lucky. We ended up having one in backup in storage. So we do have an ultra freezer on site, and we just happened to have kind of a backup that needed a part replaced at one point, and they ended up not being able to wait for it. They ordered another one, and we had fixed this one way back when, and it's just been there waiting for us.
It figures, of course, there's always a part that's needed.
There is, isn't there?
So, Jessica, as pharmacy manager, what's your role in sort of scheduling the arrival and delivery of these vaccines, and then in figuring out how to prioritize frontline workers? What role do you play?
My original role was really coordinating the vaccine deliveries. They were very specific about when's and where's of delivery. And then, of course, the storage and handling of it, making sure if we didn't have that ultra freezer, how we were going to store it, how we were going to handle it. Communicate that back to the state, monitoring the temperatures of all of our devices, our fridges, our freezers, our ultra freezer, and then preparing the vaccines. They'll need to be diluted and drawn up. So that was going to fall to us in the pharmacy. But, you know, as a small organization in the past few weeks, we've certainly all come together. We're chipping in. And, you know, if calls are needed to our employees or to our EMS groups, we're doing that, scheduling, maybe even giving some of the doses. So a little bit of everything.
And how are you determining who on staff gets the doses first? I mean, somebody has to go first, somebody has to go second. How are you determining how that line gets to run?
We're really looking to VDH for the guidance, which they were able to give us. So they told us, you know, what departments to start with, that we're starting with our emergency department, our ICU staff, EMS, and then so forth and so on into the following weeks. Because it's a short timeline and we just found out that we're getting doses today and we're looking to open up schedules for the actual vaccines tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday, we're really just kind of doing it on who's available to get it, who has the flexibility to come down for a vaccine within those groups.
So it's sort of dependent a little bit on what your work schedule is in some ways, too?
It is, yeah, a little dependent on work schedules, who's available, who may be out of town, and also keeping in mind who's available 3 weeks from now because, you know, as the ladies mentioned earlier, it's very important that they get dose number two. So we're really trying to make sure not only are they available in the next few weeks while we do clinics, but are they available in 3 weeks to get dose number two.
What is the atmosphere like around this at Northwestern Medical Center, Jessica? I mean, what does it feel like as people await these initial doses?
You know, there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of buzz about it. In general, it sounds like people are excited to have it here on site, excited to be able to get the vaccine. You know, it's heartwarming to see everybody who's come together to make it a possibility. I was a little worried up front thinking, you know, we've got staff that are working around the clock and everybody's stretched thin and maybe short-staffed, but everybody is just really pulling together to make this a possibility.
Well, on what is a busy day, clearly, as you await the shipment of these initial doses to arrive at your hospital, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Thank you very much, Jessica.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
That's Jessica Abelez, pharmacy manager at Northwestern Medical Center in St. Albans. Northwestern expected to get about 145 doses for week one today and will begin administering shots tomorrow. More questions from listeners about the vaccine and also some questions that we should get to about how the vaccine is being still researched. Kelly Dougherty, one of the questions is about when the vaccine will be able to be administered to children and what kind of research is needed to figure out the safety of the vaccine in children, the efficacy, and also what kind of dose, because the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is currently only authorized for use in those over the age of 16. As I understand it, we're still in fairly initial stages of understanding and testing on children. So how is that going to work?
That is correct, Jane. There have not been any clinical trials yet for children under the age of 12. And, you know, it's typical to test vaccines on adults before you test them on children, but it needs to be specifically authorized.
Oh, looks like we lost the line to Kelly there. We're talking with Kelly Dougherty, who's leading the health department's vaccine planning. We'll see if we can get her back here in a moment, because I am interested to hear more about children. Kelly, do we have you?
Can you hear me?
Yes, there you are.
Okay. Oh, sorry about that.
No, it's you know, 2020. We're just going to chalk it up to 2020.
Right. Did you hear any of what I said about children, or should I start?
No, yes, you said, you know, it is typical to obviously test in adults before children, and this has not been tested in children under the age of 12, I think you said, and that's about where we lost you.
Yeah, so, and vaccines need to be specifically authorized for use in children. And so, unfortunately, we don't know yet when we're going to have a vaccine that is available for children under, like you said, Pfizer is authorized for use in those 16 and older. We don't know. We don't have a timeline yet on when we're going to see a vaccine for younger children.
I've been really interested in this because you may have seen, I'm sure you have, the interactive New York Times widget where you can put in your age and what county you live in, and then it'll sort of give you a visualization of where you might be in line for the COVID vaccine. And it looks like that tracker, at least, is anticipating that children would be in line before healthy adults who are not frontline workers and don't have underlying conditions. And that was confusing to me because it seems to me that it's going to take a little while to get this tested and then authorized for use in children. And I've heard some people say it may not even be given and administered to children before the start of the 2021 school year. So, what is the timing that we should keep in mind as we think about children and the vaccine?
Yeah, I think that that tracker just is looking more just at the populations and not really at the particulars of each vaccine that is potentially coming out soon. So, you know, each vaccine that comes out, you know, has its own, you know, population that it's been tested on, and then the recommendations that come from the FDA and the advisory committee. So I think that tracker is really looking independently of the specifics of the vaccines that are available. So I think if all vaccines were available to all people, that would be a little bit more accurate. I have seen what you just said, the potentially, you know, not until around the start of the 2021 school year as well. And I think it just speaks to just sort of an unknown, you know, that we don't really know when it will be available for children. I think we're all hoping that it will be available soon and around the same time as it becomes available to the general population of adults, but we just simply don't know that yet.
Tracy Dolan, I have a question for you as we approach the end of the year and holiday gatherings. We are already into Hanukkah, and we are still living under the governor's order to not gather with members outside of our household, with some exceptions. He said today in the press conference that he's still waiting to determine, to give sort of a final determination of whether that no gathering rule is going to be in place through Christmas and New Year's, or if there could be a loosening of restrictions. We saw over 100 cases 3 days in a row, then 60 cases today. But as he pointed out, one day does not a trend make. So what are the considerations that are going into that that question of whether people should plan for, expect, anticipate anything around holiday gatherings toward the end of the month?
Yeah, as the governor said, we're still under his current executive order, which requires no multi-household gatherings and really keeping that social circle tight. The kinds of things that we think about when we make policies like this are the positivity rate, number one, of course. So yesterday's numbers were great, but we would want to see those numbers on multiple days. And we look at other things like what's happening in our long-term care facilities. I mean, we had good numbers yesterday, but we also very tragically had four deaths. And we are in a time right now where we're seeing, you know, quite a high number of deaths in our long-term care facilities. So even when we see possibly numbers go down, there is the domino effect, and it takes a little while for it to reach sometimes our most vulnerable population. So all of that comes into play. We are feeling really fortunate and thankful to Vermonters. It really looks like people heeded the governor and really stuck to the guidelines, particularly around Thanksgiving. You know, we know that Canada saw a big spike after Thanksgiving due to large gatherings. And here in Vermont, it really looks like people paid attention. Our contact tracing team tells us that they are not finding many cases, if any cases, or certainly no outbreaks that appear to be related to Thanksgiving gatherings. So that is successful and it's great, but it may mean, depending on our numbers, that we continue in this pattern. I think that'll be up to the governor and to our commissioner as we look at the numbers to see what we need to do, either continue to do or to do differently. I did want to piggyback on just one comment at the end when we're talking about protecting children. I think all of these things also come back to children and our most vulnerable populations, like our elderly adults. Even if vaccines aren't available for children for a while, the best thing we can do for kids in terms of the vaccine is for adults who are able to get vaccinated. In addition to that, continue to mask, continue to socially stay distanced. These are all things we can do to protect children. As much as we would like to see children getting vaccinated safely, we can do a lot to protect kids by continuing to do the things we're doing now. And when a vaccine comes available, to get vaccinated, go back for your second dose, because we can do a cocooning type of effect. And that will also protect our children.
Let's go to Richard in Groton. Hey, Richard, go right ahead.
Hi, I had a question about folks who live on the New Hampshire border and whose primary doctor and pharmacy, in some cases, is in New Hampshire. And how is that going to work? Are we going to need to find folks over here?
Yeah, Deputy Commissioner Dougherty, if you live in Vermont but have your medical facilities in New Hampshire or vice versa, what should you expect?
Yep. So you can expect to be able to receive your vaccine from where you get your health care typically. So if you live in the border town like Richard and you're traveling across to New Hampshire for your health care, then you can expect to be vaccinated there.
Under New Hampshire's guidelines and whatever they determine for the order.
Yes.
Okay. We got a note from Beth who says, I'm a recently retired nurse in Brattleboro with a current license. I'd like to volunteer to help vaccinate. Who should I contact?
That is a great question. I would love to get Beth's contact information. We actually are recruiting from within state government. We've put a call out to the health department is not the only department in state government that employs nurses. And so we've put a call out for folks to sort of join our vaccine effort when the time comes for our district offices to do their vaccine clinics. So if I could make contact with Beth or, that would be wonderful. I can pass her information along to the folks who are organizing that effort.
Sure. We will try to connect you with Beth after the program to make sure that we can get in touch, get you two in touch. We just have a minute left, but one thing that we haven't touched on yet, and we can talk more deeply about in future shows and on VPR elsewhere, is health equity and how to ensure that people who are at high risk, not necessarily because of health conditions, but, for example, because of race and ethnicity, we know that people of color are contracting the virus at much higher rates. Kelly Dougherty, how is the state taking into account health equity as you determine the distribution of vaccine doses?
Yeah, I'm so glad that this topic came up, Jane, in the short amount of time that we have left. We have a health equity person at the health department, but also on our vaccine advisory committee. We've purposefully engaged with organizations that serve folks who are in those populations, because we want to make sure that all along the way we are considering issues of equity. And, you know, one example I would say is that, you know, when we were talking about healthcare workers, you know, we made very sure to make sure that we encompass not just, you know, doctors and nurses, but everyone who's coming into contact with patients who may be, you know, lower income, who, you know, like the nutrition staff or the maintenance staff. So we are looking at that in every phase, and we'll be considering that more, especially as we broaden to the more general population and make sure that we can communicate with folks in a way that resonates with them.
Good. Well, we look forward to hearing more about that and all things related to vaccine distribution. There's clearly an appetite for that. Deputy Health Commissioners Tracy Dolan and Kelly Dougherty, thank you very much for spending time with us today.